expanded.
Please be seated. Well, we chickened out and didn't come back during the fire alarm. I thought, why come sit down and all we're going to do is have to close our ears? Let's see, you have a little different timeline on the schedule that's been given to me, so I want to go over it to be sure I know what you all are going to be doing. So Attorney Silver, you will begin with 25 minutes, and then 15 minutes by Attorney LaPlumb. Okay, 15 minutes by attorney, please. And then back again with you for 5 minutes for rebuttal, correct? Okay. All right, if you are prepared to proceed, please do. Oh, I'm supposed to remind you. So Marshall told me before we came out that you all know Justice Abrahamson is listening. So just a second reminder. Thank you.
If it may please the court, my name is Patrick Silver. I represent Secure Insurance, a mutual company. Thanks for hearing this case. I think the briefing is very good on both sides, and I encourage you to take a good close look at the briefing as well as the principal cases that are discussed. I want to frame the main issue and then give you a brief overview of what I think are the relevant points. The issue here is fairly straightforward. There was a forest fire that broke out in May of 2013 in Douglas County. It burned for 3 days, and numerous properties were damaged and destroyed. The fire broke out as a result of operations by Duer Logging, a logging company that was performing logging and lumbering operations in the area. And the question is whether there was one occurrence for purposes of the liability policy that was issued to Duer Logging. That policy was issued by my client, Secura Insurance. So I think the way to approach this is pretty simple. Number one, we look at the plain language of the policy. We always do that when we interpret contracts. Number two, we make sure that we apply the law in looking at the plain language. And we always do that. You never just look at the language, because there are rules about how you're supposed to interpret the language in the policy. So we'll get to that. And then number three, I want to look at some of the cases that have treated the way in which the cause theory and the effect theory have been applied in cases involving damages to multiple claimants as a result of fires, and also other cases that address the cause theory. So we begin with the language. This policy has a standard insuring agreement. It also includes a section entitled Limits of Insurance. And that Limits of Insurance section, it's in the appendix, says, among other things, that the limits shown fix the most that will be paid regardless of the number of insureds, claims made, or suits brought, or persons or organizations making claims or bringing suits. That's one thing it says. Another thing it says is that the each occurrence limit is the most that will be paid for the sum of all damages under coverage A, which is the coverage section that provides for coverage for property damage. It also says that it's the most that will be paid because of property damage arising out of any one occurrence. Now, we know that for purposes of interpreting an insurance policy, the words arising out of are very broadly construed. All that is required is some causal connection between the peril at issue and the damage that results. Any causal connection. So here, you've got a fire that breaks out in the cutting head of a logging implement. The fire spreads into the grass.
Counsel, when you say there only needs to be any causal connection, are you sure you want to be that broad, or is it proximate causal connection?
The phrase any causal connection is a quote from the Garaguenk case, which addresses the appearance of the phrase arising out of in the context of an exclusion, no less. And exclusions are normally construed narrowly against an insurance company and in favor of coverage. So the phrase is arising out of, and it's deemed to be any causal connection. Now here the fire broke out in the cutting, had spread into the woods, and became a running crown fire, and it burned continuously for roughly 3 days, consuming everything in its path and covering 8,000 miles. The DNR report, which is a part of the public record, documents what everybody knew, which is that the conditions were exceedingly dry and that there were high winds. So there's no question that this was a significant fire that was never interrupted. It's possible that different parts of the fire may have attacked different individual items of tangible property at different points in time, but that's a truism. That's true of any kind of fire or any destructive event. So we've got this limit of insurance provision in the base form, says that the limit is the most that will be paid because of all property damage arising out of any one occurrence. So even if you could deem different aspects of the 8,000-acre fire to be a different occurrence, they all arose out of one occurrence, which is initially the fire breaking out in the cutting head, flowing continuously, if you will, spreading, and eventually consuming everything in its path. Now, this limit of insurance clause is subject to an endorsement. It's called the Logging and Lumbering Operations Endorsement. And among other things, this one paper, which is in the appendix, it amends the limits by saying that the $1 million each occurrence limit is amended to $500,000 as respects property damage due to fire arising from logging or lumbering operations by Duer Logging. So, take a big step back and think about how do we interpret this insurance policy. You've got a liability policy that's issued to a logging and lumbering company. We know that it's a logging and lumbering company and that particular aspect of its practice is recognized in the policy. It's part of the way in which the risk of underwriting liability is rated. The fact that it's a logging and lumbering company is reflected expressly at least two different times on the declarations pages. It's also noteworthy that the premium that was paid for this liability coverage was $663. That's not a lot of money. And the fact that it's not a lot of money suggests that there are limitations on what the parties were bargaining for in entering into this insuring agreement. That's something that courts can take into consideration. That is, that a premium paid and the amount paid goes to an understanding of what the intent of the parties was at the time of contracting.
Can I have you focus, counsel, on when we talk about occurrence and what you were defining the occurrence as? The Court of Appeals stated on page 9 of their opinion that you had acknowledged that the occurrence was the damage to the properties caused by fire, not the operation of its equipment. So how are you defining the occurrence?
The occurrence is not the damage. The occurrence is the damage-causing event. And here, the initial damage was to the grassland of the company on which the logging operation was taking place. So you've got this fire that breaks out in a cutting head. Now, the equipment belongs to Duer Logging, but its own equipment is not covered for liability purposes. So the first thing that is damaged is the actual grassland where the fire begins to spread. And the damage-causing event is the heat from the fire itself. That is, if you wish to put it this way, an occurrence. And because the limits expressly say that the limits are the most paid for the sum of all damages under coverage A because of property damage arising out of any one occurrence, I think it's reasonable to conclude that when you have a situation when a fire breaks out, especially giving a policy issued to a logging company, especially when you only pay $663 a year for liability coverage, especially when you've got an express endorsement that limits the amount payable for damages arising out of fire caused by logging operations, I think it's reasonable to conclude that what the parties intended was that the most that will be paid for all damages arising out of a fire caused by a logging operation is $500,000. That's the reasonable, plain language interpretation of this policy. Now then, let's turn to the way the law addresses these issues. Wisconsin applies the cause theory. The cause theory was first addressed in Olson versus Moore, which was a 1972 case. That was an accident involving three cars. And I want to caution that it's not easy to map onto all of these cases the specific facts in this particular case. Olson concerned a case where you had a driver who crossed the median, hit a car coming in the opposite direction, that car went into the ditch, the defendant tortfeasor continued and then hit another car. And the question was whether the injuries to the five different people involved in the accident was a result of one occurrence. This was the first time the Supreme Court dealt with this issue of the cause theory. And in Olson, the court carefully goes through the cases and authority that address the cause theory and contrasts that with other cases which are deemed the minority view, called the effect theory. So, Olson says that the issue before the court there is whether an accident or an occurrence in a liability policy should be viewed from the perspective of cause or effect. The court says, if viewed from the point of view of a cause, it would appear that a single uninterrupted cause, which results in a number of injuries or separate instances of property damage, is yet one accident or occurrence. If, however, the cause is interrupted or replaced by another cause, the chain of causation is broken and more than one accident or occurrence has taken place. Olson concludes that the majority view, that is the cause theory, is the appropriate theory to apply in the state of Wisconsin. And in that case, they concluded that there was not a broken, uninterrupted chain, that there was a single occurrence, and that therefore the single occurrence limit was applicable.
It seems that the Falk case and the Plastics Engineering Company cases are the ones that the Court of Appeals really focused on in terms of that cause theory and really focused on those in terms of their decision. So can you distinguish both of those cases from this case?
The first one was Falk.
Falk,
the other one?
Plastics Engineering Company.
Plastics Engineering, sure. Let's start with plastics since it was an earlier case. Well, that is easy to distinguish on the facts. That case involved thousands of claimants bringing personal injury claims as a result of exposure over a period of years due to exposure to numerous products manufactured by Plenco, some company that had asbestos in its products. The claims covered injuries by thousands of individuals that were geographically spread out all over the country. These claims and the exposures and the injuries took place over 30 years. And in plastics engineering, the Supreme Court concluded that there was an occurrence with respect to each claimant's injury, and the presumption is that's because there were different instances where different products were exposed to the different individual claimants over a period of time. We don't know if the products all came out of the same factory at the same time, if they were the same products, if the claimants were all exposed to one single individual product. We just don't know that. What we do know is that the facts are clearly distinguishable, literally 3 decades and thousands of claimants. Now, Falk is a little bit different, and it's arguably not quite as far removed on the facts as plastics engineering, but I think that it's clearly distinguishable.
What about the policy language and definition of occurrence?
In plastics engineering, the policy language did not include a logging and lumbering operations endorsement, and the court did not really address the specific limits of insurance language that I quoted from. Even if that language was similar, the focus was not on whether the limits of insurance language limiting coverage to the sum of all damages arising out of any one occurrence. They didn't focus on that. It wasn't especially argued. The question was there a separate occurrence with respect to the different exposures of the individual claimants over this 30-year period of time where people are geographically dispersed all across the country and exposed to different products? In Falk, the language is also different. Falk, the language concerned a damage to property of other endorsement. And it's important to recognize that this damage to property of others endorsement merely provided a $500 coverage sum available to those who were damaged as a result of an occurrence. Now, this is briefed, and I encourage you to go back and look at the arguments that we make. In Falk, the real focus in the case was on whether the pollution exclusion applied. I think that's fairly obvious. It's a 71-paragraph decision. 5 paragraphs at the very end deal with this issue of whether exposure to the pollutants was one occurrence or more than one occurrence. And only 2 of those paragraphs really provide any analysis. The other 3 simply recite the issue and state what the policy language is. Equally important, the parties in Falk didn't even raise this issue in their principal briefing. In other words, you go back and you look at the appellant's or petitioner's brief, the idea of whether there was one occurrence or more than one occurrence was not even addressed. It was addressed in a respondent's brief. There was a slight reply, but if you take the entirety of all of the briefs that were filed in the Court of Appeals in Falk, and you take all of the briefs that were filed in the Supreme Court, the entirety of all the arguments on this issue of whether there was one or more occurrence is about 2 to 3 pages total. So the issue really wasn't developed very well.
Counsel?
Yes.
You started your argument by discussing how we approach the interpretation of language in the policy. And one of the averments that you made was that we look at the language, of course, and then we apply some canons of construction. Your brief speaks of language should not be interpreted to give way to absurd results. And pages 16 and 17 and other pages of your brief address this. What absurd results do you think exist in the interpretation espoused by your opposing counsel?
That's a good question, and I'm happy to address it. One absurd result is that you end up having to treat the specific instance of damage to each individual item of tangible property as potentially a separate occurrence. Give you a hypothetical. Suppose you've got a house and it has 5 paintings in it, each of which are worth $500,000. Suppose a fire breaks out in the garage. It finds its way into the kitchen, and soon the first painting worth $500,000 is destroyed. Eventually, the same thing happens as the fire reaches the living room and then into the bedrooms upstairs, and over a period of, say, 2 hours, all 5 paintings are damaged and destroyed. Under the theory espoused by the respondents, there would be a separate occurrence each time the fire, quote-unquote, seeped from one room into the next, damaging first this item of tangible property, then this one, then this one. And the insurance company would presumably be on the hook for $500,000 maximum for each individual painting, a total of $2.5 million. If the insurer had a $2 million aggregate limit, that would be the most that would be owed. Under this policy, we would claim only $500,000 would be owed because of the language in the limits of insurance provision and in the endorsement. So that's one absurdity that results. It's a sort of related argument, but if you try to apply this thinking in other domains, it also really runs afoul of reasonable expectations. Take instances of mold infestation. Take instances of an infection from some bacteria or some virus. If you have a bodily injury because you step on a nail, somebody's negligent and leaves that out their house. Well, you may have a bacteria in your foot. It may produce an injury. The bacteria reproduces. It travels throughout your body. Now you've got sepsis. 72 hours later, now you've got a fever. Now you've got other injuries. If you treat each individual instance of injury or damage as a separate occurrence, there's no reasonable stopping point. I think it runs afoul of common sense. And I think it doesn't follow the way the law is addressed in Wisconsin, and it doesn't follow the policy language or the cause theory. I left off discussing the cause theory as articulated in Olson versus Moore. There is an important aspect of the decision which I want the court to consider. It discusses the effect theory. Remember, that's the minority view. And it recognizes that under the effect theory, you look at the issue of whether there's an occurrence from the point of view of the injured party. So if you have three different injured parties, then the effect from their point of view is three separate occurrences. Wisconsin rejects that perspective. One of the reasons it rejects that perspective is because it's inconsistent with the principle of proximate cause. And proximate cause is an issue that's addressed in Olson, it's addressed in the case law that Olson looks to, and it's also addressed in non-Wisconsin cases that treat issues of fires that give rise to damages sustained by multiple claimants. Olson also reminds us that the policy language defining an occurrence as an accident, including continuous or repeated exposure to the same general harmful conditions, is not ambiguous. And even though courts and parties may struggle to apply undisputed facts to a policy, that doesn't make the contract ambiguous. Now, I'm not going to run through all of the cases because my time is short. I do want to remind the court that there are a number of non-Wisconsin decisions that address the issue of whether there is more or one occurrence in circumstances involving fires. Every single one of those cases, every one, holds that there's one occurrence. So in the Denham case, a hotel fire, 17 hours of damage. The court determined there was one occurrence, even though there were 250 hotel guests, each of whom claimed some kind of damage or loss to their property as a result of the fire. That case, incidentally, also addresses the issue of proximate cause. And critically, it links proximate cause not simply to the damage-causing event, but also to the conduct that gives rise to the injury or damage at issue. That's also treated in the Welter versus Singer case. Court wants to look at the idea that it's not simply what happened, but rather what is the conduct that resulted in the damage at issue. Did the tortfeasor engage in negligence, then regain control of their vehicle, and then engage in a separate, independent, later instance of negligence? Under the proximate cause theory, if there is no intervening or superseding cause, if there is no uninterrupted causation, if There is no separate, independent, later act of negligence. Under proximate cause and under the cause theory, there is one continuous, uninterrupted cause and therefore one occurrence. Finally, in the Barrett case, that was a building fire. It burned for 2 hours. You had, I believe, 7 claimants. Tri-State Roofing, that was a case where a roofing company dropped tar that caught on fire. The fire spread throughout a number of other areas and caused damage to 11 different buildings. I believe that that fire burned for a number of hours. There's also the New England Box Company. These are cases all treated in the ALR, which is referenced in the briefing, I believe. If not, I can provide you the citation. And I encourage the court to go back and look at that law report, because it treats extensively the issue of what constitutes a single accident or occurrence within a liability policy. That's 64 ALR 4668. If you look at that ALR, you'll find that in every single instance, when there are multiple damages claimed by multiple persons as a result of a fire that burns for an extended period of time, each instance there's one occurrence subject to the one occurrence policy limit. I see I still have my yellow light, but I don't find that there's any need to kind of run down the time. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer. Otherwise, I'll defer to my esteemed colleague, Mr. LaFlamme.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Silver. Good morning, Chief Justice, fellow justices. My name is Eugene LaFlamme. I'm here representing the respondents, the Lyme St. Croix defendants. There's 4 of them. Instead of going through their lengthy names, I'll simply refer to them as the Lyme St. Croix defendants. I'm here with my co-counsel, Nick Harkin, as well. And Attorney Pless will be taking the last 15 minutes of our argument. As the Chief Justice noted, Attorney Pless is here on behalf of Stagerwald.
And what part of the argument are you focusing on as opposed to other counsel?
Thank you. That's a very good question, because we struggled with that ourselves. I'm going to be taking the policy language argument, and Mr. Pless is going to be discussing the cause theory argument. As an initial matter, and as Attorney Silver noted, we need to look at the policy language. And it is the policy language that controls how this outcome results. The policy language in Secura, when we look at the definition of occurrence, it includes an accident, including continuous or repeated exposure to substantially the same general harmful condition. Now, the term exposure is very important in that definition. The term exposure is the same occurrence definition that was used in both the Planko, the plastics engineering, and the Fault case. Under the term exposure, a property is not exposed to the fire until it is damaged. The property that is 2 miles down the road is not exposed to a fire when the spark drops out of the logging equipment and starts a ground fire immediately underneath it. That property is exposed to the fire when it reaches that property line.
How do you draw the property line? The Court of Appeals drew it at the actual property line, residential or whatever it was, but why not draw it at individual pieces of property?
Well, and Justice Bradley, I think that in the Planko case, that issue was somewhat addressed in that there was a discussion as to whether each individual exposure or each episode of exposure constituted an occurrence, or did just the exposure as a general proposition constitute as an occurrence. And in that instance, the decision said, again, we turn to the language of the policy, which defines occurrence as continuous or repeated exposure to conditions. That's the same definition that we have in the Secura policy. The exposure must quite obviously be exposure to the injured person and not the exposure to Planko. So what we are talking about is once it becomes an exposure to the person, the person is making these claims.
But my question goes to, let's take an individual piece of land, and let's say my house sits on that piece of land. The way the Court of Appeals drew the line, they said, okay, each property owner experiences a separate occurrence. But I don't see a basis in the law for doing that, because another way to draw the line would have been to say, Justice Bradley's home was affected by fire, her car was sitting on her property lot, and that was a separate occurrence because that piece of property was also affected. I don't see a basis in the law for drawing the line where the Court of Appeals did instead of drawing it more specifically to individual items of property on a piece of land.
Well, Justice, in that instance, you also need to take into effect the cause theory, and you need to take into effect the time and space aspect of it. If it's all on one property, there is no time and space distinction. That fire has affected that property in its totality at that time.
Well, not necessarily, because it could have started on a piece of brush or a tree on the property, and then it could have spread first to the house, and later on it could have moved over to the garage and hit the car. So the way that fire moves, it could have affected individual pieces of property on that land. Why aren't those separate occurrences?
Well, the individual pieces of property would still be part of one single claim by a person. So they wouldn't be multiple occurrences because it would still be the single claim.
But then didn't the Court of Appeals really apply the effect test? Because they're looking at the effect on the individual property owner.
I think the Court of Appeals applied the test that was espouted in both Falk and in the Planko case. Because in both of those cases, we did look at, under the time and space considerations, when there are large gaps in both of those instances, that it is the damage to the property. So it is not applying the effects test. It is undertaking the cause theory and applying the time and space considerations. And we would also assert the unique circumstances, which Mr. Pless will get into later, should be a third aspect to that test.
Counsel, but your argument doesn't depend on the space and time and all of that. It depends on a change in ownership, doesn't it?
Well, certainly. In justice, in our society, that is the way that we define property. We draw arbitrary property lines, and individuals' property is confined within those property lines. So the exposure to that individual does not occur until the fire crosses over that property line.
Where does the language of the policy refer to the individual or imply a change in ownership?
Well, again, we have to go back to the exposure aspect of the occurrence definition.
Yes.
And under the exposure aspect of it, an individual cannot have damage or cannot incur the property damage until it is actually exposed to it. So it's not the fire that started 2 miles up the road that exposes that property to the damage. It's once that fire crosses their property line and then affects their property.
I think you're stealing a little bit of an intellectual base here, because the fire that started 2 miles up the road is the cause of the damage on your insured's property. Why does it matter that he owns it as opposed to someone else? As a matter of time and space and causation, it's all the same thing. So your responsibility here, I think, is to find some suggestion in the language of occurrence that is based upon the ownership of property rather than simply property that gets harmed.
Well, Your Honor, when there is a contract term or contract language that is open to multiple interpretations and multiple reasonable interpretations, then it is deemed ambiguous and it is found in favor of coverage, which I think is what we have here. We have a term, occurrence, which has been defined and addressed in both Planko and Falk. And in Falk, in a certainly very similar circumstance as we have here. In Falk, we had a situation where there was some spreading of manure on a field that then contaminated wells and adjacent properties. Much like we have a fire here that started in one location, and then that fire, through a number of different circumstances, transformed into multiple fires.
But there's a factual difference in that case, isn't there? Because the spreading of the manure was intentional, and it was okay to do that. They were putting manure on to fertilize the fields or whatever. Here, obviously, the fire was not intentional. It was a result of the accident at the logging site, right?
Well, the spreading of the manure is no different than the logging operations. The logging operations in and of themselves was an intentional act.
But there was an accident that triggered the fire, right?
Just as there was an accident in where or the manner in which they spread the manure that allowed it to seep into the wells. So there was an accident in both instances that derived from an intentional or an affirmative act that was perfectly lawful. And that's how we get to the occurrence issue in this instance.
So let's test how far that goes. So let's say that your insured owns property parcel A. Adjacent to that is property parcel B, owned by someone else. And then there's property parcel C, and it's owned by your insured. And the fire goes from parcel A to B to C. How many occurrences?
Well, in that instance, Your Honor, it would be each time it crosses a property line, because that is the exposure to that property owner, which brings us back to the policy language under the occurrence, which includes continuous or repeated exposure to substantially the same general harmful conditions.
All right. So so now let's say parcels A, B, and C are all owned by your insured. How many occurrences?
Well, if they are separate and distinct property lines, Your Honor, then...
No.
Okay.
Just one parcel.
And then if it's a single parcel, then it would be a single occurrence.
Okay. So the number of occurrences depends upon the change of ownership from one person to another.
Correct, Your Honor. And I think that's what the Court of Appeals and Trial Court ruled as well in following the precedent that was set in Falk and in Planko and following the methodology that this Court instructed them to.
All right. So then how does that differ from the effects test?
Well, because under the cause theory, you still do have time, space, and circumstance considerations.
Let's say that's not an issue here, because, frankly, it really isn't. If your theory of the case depends upon a change in ownership, so I want to know how your theory differs from the effects test, based on the fact that your theory depends on the change in ownership.
Well, but also our theory depends upon the cause test, Your Honor, in that there is the time, space, and circumstance consideration that needs to be discussed within the context of the events and the fires that occurred.
Well, let's talk about the time and space, because I do think that is something...
Could I actually get an answer to my question first?
Okay, go ahead.
So, So tell me how this differs from the effects test. Let's put to one side for a moment the time and space. How does this differ from effects?
Well, because under the effects test, you are looking purely at the number of injured parties and each potential, meaning if you have multiple exposures, there's going to be multiple claims. So the effects test could potentially, under Mr. Silver's argument, in theory, follow through to each individual item that is damaged, whereas under the cause theory, you're looking at the time and space, and I know you didn't want me to get into the cause theory, but really that is what rules the day in the determination of whether there is one or two or multiple occurrences in this case.
If you applied the effects test, how many occurrences would there be in this case?
There would be certainly a number, Your Honor.
Okay. Would it be the same number as if we applied the cause test under your understanding of how that works?
I would have to take a look at it under the effects test, but potentially there could be some similarity in that regard. But we need to look at the policy language again, because that's really what we come back to.
That's what I thought you were going to talk about, the policy language and the words that define occurrence.
Yes.
Can you remind me whether your policy language, the Secura policy language, is identical to the language in Planko and Falk, or are there differences? Because I thought in those cases, occurrence was tethered to a resultant injury. Is that exact language the same language present here? And remind me, did Wilson Mutual argue that each contamination was not a new occurrence?
Your Honor, the language is very similar between Secura and Planko and Falk. They all include the general first statement that an accident, including continuous or repeated exposure to substantially the same general harmful conditions, Planko then goes on, which results in bodily...
Wait, does this policy talk about the resultant injury when it defines occurrence?
Not within the context of occurrence, Your Honor, but in order to trigger any sort of claim under the CGL policy, you have to have bodily injury or property damage. So whether it's within the definition of occurrence or not is really a distinction without a difference, because you are not going to get a claim under this policy unless you have bodily injury or property damage.
So is it your position that the court did not find it relevant in those cases, Planko and Falk, that the policy language discussed the resultant injury?
The important part of those cases was the term exposure. And I think in your opinion, Justice Ziegler, you put it right when that the exposure in the definition of occurrence must quite obviously be the exposure to the injured person, not the exposure to Planko. So it wasn't the exposure to Ray Doerr when the fire started beneath the logging equipment. It was the exposure to the claimant once it crossed the property line.
And now you're in Wilson, right? Did Wilson make the argument that this is a single occurrence?
Wilson was somewhat undefined in that regard, and no, I do not believe that they made that argument that it was a single occurrence in that regard. And probably part of that may have been because of the limits that were at issue. They were talking $500 at that time per occurrence, as opposed to here we're talking $500,000. So I think the motivation on Secura to raise that argument is probably a little higher in this regard.
Okay. So can I take you to the issue of time and location, which is when we look at the cause theory, it talks about this uninterrupted nature of the event and the closeness in time and location between the event and the injuries. And it also talks about what a reasonable person would consider or an average person would consider as one event. So I'm kind of giving you two questions. First, to talk about timing and location here when you have an uninterrupted fire and how you distinguish that from the cause theory. And then second, what would an average person think of as one event in terms of a fire? Would they think of it as every time the fire refuels and crosses to someone else's property, it's a new fire?
Well, Justice, my red light is up. If you don't mind, I can answer it,
yes,
or I can pass it to co-counsel.
You can answer her question.
Well, or if you want to pass to co-counsel, that's up to you.
I can certainly address it. Thank you. So under the time and space theory, in this instance, we had a fire that burned 8,000 acres. The fire was not uninterrupted. The fire was a crown fire. The fire was a ground fire. The fire transitioned also as a result of fire brands, which are basically sparks that are carried by wind that then ignite another fire somewhere else where there had not been an active fire going. There was also an exposure fire. So we have four different types of fires that occurred. We also have instances where the fire jumped a roadway or jumped other obstacles where there was no fire in between. So we did not have one uninterrupted fire. This fire was certainly interrupted. This fire was multiple. It took multiple forms, and it affected multiple properties.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, I'd like you to finish the question asked by Justice Dallet. That question is, what would the average person think? Would they think every time a fire refuels, it's a new fire? Your co-counsel indicated that in his response, if it jumps a roadway, crosses the street, it's a new fire. What would the reasonable person or the average person say as you advance?
Thank you, Justice Bradley. My name is Eric Kless. I represent Steiger Wolf Land Services. Excellent question. In this particular case, we have a fire that was 10 miles from its point of origin to its point of terminus. In those 10 miles, it crossed over several different roadways, including county roadways and a state highway. It crossed over several fire breaks dug by the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. So when you have a fire on the left side of the road that comes up to the road, and then firebrands blow it across, now we have a fire on the left and the right.
I'll tell you, this makes no sense to me. And so you've got your charge in part, your task this morning is to make sense of it to all seven of us, including me. Let's say I'm in my hometown, Richland Center. Let's say there's a fire in the at the feed mill, which there was years ago. Are you saying, and it's right on First Avenue, are you saying that then when the fire goes from First Avenue to the Second Avenue, it's a new fire, and to the Third Avenue, it's a new fire, and when it gets to our home on the Fifth Avenue, it's a new fire? That makes no sense to me.
Well, the answer is it depends.
It depends on the unique facts of the case.
Yes. Exactly.
And that's why however this court decides this case, it should be tethered to the unique facts of this case. Is that your position, or is that just me hoping that's your position?
Well, what we would advocate is we would advocate that the court issue an opinion that clarifies and harmonizes the existing body of case law and provide some guidance to the practitioners who actually practice in this area on a daily basis.
Okay, let me just say, I'm sitting there on Fifth Avenue in my house, and someone says to me, and let's just say, for argument purposes, that I'm a reasonable person. Let's say it's not even debatable.
For argument purposes, we'll give
you. Do you think that I would say, oh, my house was damaged because of the fire that came from 4th Avenue to 5th Avenue? Or would I say, it's the feed mill fire? What would the reasonable person think?
Well, it would depend upon the time and space analysis. If that happens all within a very short amount of time, within a relatively confined space, I would think they would think that would be from the feed mill fire. Now let's take it a little bit farther in that feed mill fire.
Well, but you advance the argument, as I heard it, and your co-counsel, when it crosses the road, it is a new fire. And that's what causes me to respond with some skepticism.
Well, there is a difference between a quote-unquote new fire and a different occurrence under the policy. The body of case law that we have is in regard to Plenko and Falk. In those cases, if you look at the cause theory, the courts still found that there were multiple occurrences. The petitioner would have you believe that we are asking this court to abandon the cause theory and adopt the effect theory. That's not the case at all. What we're saying is, under the existing body of case law, using the cause theory, as the Plenko court did and the Falk court did, this should be multiple occurrences. And we would ask this court to adopt a clear test that all practitioners can use that has been discussed over the years in these various cases, but it's never really come down as a clear test. And that three-factor test we would advocate would be time, space, and a third factor that Justice Abramson described as a variety of circumstances in her concurrence in the Plenko case. That could be a number of things, like an intervening factor or other factors. In this particular case, we think that using that three-factor test, the result is multiple occurrences. And here's why. First
all
of
right.
all,
Tom, Counsel, before yep. you go there, if this is to be a clear and easy test to apply, can you tell me how many fires were involved here?
I suppose you could say there was one fire, but that constitutes multiple occurrences.
Okay. How many occurrences were there?
According to the Court of Appeals opinion, there would be about 100.
And according to your opinion?
Well, if you look at the rationale of Plenko, I certainly understand how the Court of Appeals reached their decision. In Plenko, we had one dispersal of asbestos in a variety of products that caused many personal injuries over many periods of a long time. With the exception of the Larsons, who are in the caption, we don't really have personal injuries in this case. What we do have is injuries to real property. And in the Plenko case, we have injuries to person, and so each person had a different cause of action, a different occurrence under that policy. Coming back to our case, The way we as a society define real property is not like bodily integrity, like a personal injury case. Rather, it's property lines. So picking up on the holding in Falk, where this court said every time there's a contamination in a different well, there's a new occurrence. The Court of Appeals in our case said every time it crosses the line to a different piece of real property, there's an occurrence.
But what in the policy language supports the Court of Appeals' decision to draw the line at the property line?
Nothing inherent within the policy language supports that. The policy says that there is a separate limit for each occurrence. And under each occurrence, with 100 different structures being damaged and 100 different pieces of property, the petitioner's aggregate limit would be used up rather quickly, which is probably why there was no formal opinion as to there are X number of occurrences under the petitioner's policy. So in direct answer to your question, it's not the policy language that governs if it goes from property A to property B, it's a different occurrence. Rather, it's the rationale that this court used in Plenko and in Falk that allowed the Court of Appeals to reach that conclusion. If we think about it in terms of personal injury for a minute, if there were a personal injury right next door to this fire, and then another personal injury 2 miles away, and another one 4 miles away, and another one 10 miles away, and this was a fire that was 10 miles as the crow flies, under the petitioner's argument, that all would be one occurrence, and all six of those people would have the same $500,000 limit that they would have to then split up. We think, under the Plenko case and under the Falk case, this court would reach a very different result. This court would say, no, those individuals have different causes of action. And as a matter of fact, even in our case, we have the Larsons who are claiming personal injuries in this case. Under the petitioner's argument, those personal injuries are just lumped in with the grass fire that's next door to the cutter head. So if you look at it in the terms of a personal injury case, if these were personal injuries, I think it is quite clear that this court and virtually all courts would say, no, that's multiple occurrences.
And that sounds outcome-oriented to me. Because after all, isn't the policy of insurance designed to protect the insured? The insured takes it out to protect itself from liability. It's not taking it out necessarily to make sure that every injured person or every property owner is fully compensated, right?
Excellent question. And that's why I kept focusing on the petitioner thinks we're trying to adopt the effects test. We're not. The example that I want to use is, let's say you have eight people sitting around a campfire and someone throws in an incendiary device and there's an explosion and eight people are injured. Under the effects theory, that would be eight separate occurrences. Under the cause theory, the three-factor test, time, space, and whether there's a variety of circumstances, that would all be one occurrence. And we would advocate that that would all be one occurrence.
You would advocate that it be one occurrence unless one of them's across the street, one of them's two blocks over, but it all came from the same fire that someone threw into the fire pit.
Well, again.
And then now you're, what, time and space? How do you define time and space? Because they're a block away, 2 blocks away, a day later? Isn't it about being uninterrupted? Isn't that more the piece of that test that the court should be focusing on?
I understand your point. As my co-counsel said, this wasn't an uninterrupted fire.
Well, that's the first time I've heard that. I didn't see that in the briefs, and maybe I missed it. So you're now saying this was not this is interrupted? That's the argument that's being made? And what interrupted it?
It was interrupted by many different fire breaks, including many different roadways, including a county roadway.
So a road interrupted the fire because it was on one side and the other?
Sure, because if you look at the DNR report, which is in the record.
Well, counsel, it wasn't much of a fire break if it left the fire break, was it?
I think the DNR had really good intentions here, but there was such a variety of circumstances that fueled this fire, including sustained 30-mile-an-hour winds.
Right, but this is, so the question is not whether DNR had good intentions. The question was whether it was a fire break, right? It's an interruption in the cause, and it wasn't. They may have tried to interrupt it, but they failed.
Well, we say there was an interruption here.
What was the interruption?
The interruption was the roadways that the DNR set up these fire breaks and...
Okay, but if they were interruptions, it would have actually interrupted it, right?
It didn't interrupt it to the point where it stopped it.
Then it's not much of an interruption, is it?
Again, this is not something that calls for a bright-line test, which is why we are advocating the three factors, time, space, and a variety of circumstances, because that's the guidance that this court let us have in Plenko and also Falk.
How, in Plenko, how does it instruct us at all that the exposures there occurred at different times, different geographical locations, and different people?
In Plenko?
Yeah.
That's the mesothelioma case where...
It's the asbestos.
Yeah, sure. I'm sorry. How does that instruct in our case?
The claimant's exposures were at different times, different people, different geographic locations.
Correct.
Separate and distinct.
Correct. And in our case, we have a period of 3 days. We have a difference of 8,000 acres with 10 miles as the crow flies between the inception of the fire and the terminus of the fire.
Well, it's a big fire. It's one big fire, right?
You could look at it as one big fire, but under the law that's been developed in Plenko and Falk, that one big fire leads us to many different occurrences because there were many different claims.
Exposures. In Plenko, there were many different exposures in different geographic locations at different periods of time. You don't see that as different?
No, I really don't, because in Plenko we have one, quote-unquote, negligent act, and that would be the dispersal of asbestos.
Okay, from May 8 of 1970 to January 1st of 1984.
Sure.
What was the time period here?
3 days.
Okay.
And over that 3 days and over those 8,000 acres... We would advocate that that satisfies the time, space, and a variety of circumstances requirement that Plenko and Falk set forth to allow for multiple occurrences.
Describe to me what an effects test would do for you.
Well, an effects test would be, I used the example of the campfire before. If you use the effects test in that situation, then eight people that were burned in the same explosion would have eight different occurrences and eight different claims. Similarly, like in a food poisoning case, if there's a case out of Illinois where one bad onion tainted 22 different hamburgers, and using the effects test, then every single individual would have a different claim and there would be a different occurrence that came out of that one tainted onion. So there is a difference between the cause analysis and the effects analysis. What we're advocating is continue the cause analysis, but under the cause analysis have a three-factor test to determine if there's one occurrence or multiple occurrences. We see this all the time in multiple car accident cases. Back in the early 1990s when I started practicing, there was a 50-car pileup on the Tower Drive Bridge. A few years later, I think there was one down in Port Washington. I see my time is up. May I briefly finish?
You may finish your answer, yes.
There was one down by Port Washington where there was a similar pileup. Using the petitioner's argument, that would all be one occurrence. So the court needs to provide some guidance here to the practitioners as to what constitutes an occurrence, and we think the three-factor test does that. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I saw Richard III over the weekend, and I was doing a little reading afterwards. I'm not making this up. And there's this old story of, like, was Shakespeare really Shakespeare, or was it His play is the result of more than one author. There was one academic out there who basically made the argument Shakespeare isn't Shakespeare. He's actually another guy with the same name. And there's something about that that kind of reminds me of the argument. I'm not trying to be too snide. Here, we have to remember that the limits of insurance provision says that the damages under the coverage because of property damage arising out of any one occurrence is subject to the $500,000 limit. So even if you take their argument at face value, we know minimally, accepting their argument, that when the grass first started burning under the cutting head, that that was the first occurrence. I'm not conceding there was more than one occurrence, but even accepting their argument. So we know that the limits are subject to all damages arising out of any one occurrence, and here you certainly had minimally at least one occurrence when the grass under the cutting head first started breaking out. This business about a three-part test and about a time and space element, there's nothing in the case law that would support applying that kind of a rule. Go back and look at Olson and go back and look at Welter, and you'll find that the reference to time and space goes to the issue of whether there were independent, temporally and spatially separate acts of negligence by the driver. Did the driver lose control, injure one party, regain control, and then engage in negligence and injure another party? That's where the time and space element comes into discussion in Olson, and it's also where it comes into play in the Welter case.
Counsel, I want to return to the language of the policy, which is where you started your argument initially. And I want to look at the logging and lumbering operations endorsement. And that section limits of insurance is amended then, of course, as you advance to $500,000 rather than the million on the declaration page. It has the language each occurrence limit. And the word each suggests to me that maybe there's multiple. Why would you use the word each if there isn't more than one? Why doesn't it say an occurrence limit, but it says each?
Because the declarations page uses the phrase each occurrence with a capital E and a capital O. That's what the reference is there. If the language was to be interpreted in the way you're suggesting, it wouldn't be necessary to use each with a capital E, occurrence with a capital O, and limit with a capital L. That's a reference back to the declarations page.
So the declarations page generally isn't considered as part of the contract itself.
Of course it is. Very important part of the contract.
But depending on what case you read.
I don't want to argue with you, but I don't know of any case that says that the declarations page is not a part of the contract.
Backward, turn backward, oh time in its flight. When I was doing insurance defense, there were cases that said that.
I want to just add a couple of other points because I was scrambling furiously. The Planko case was not about one dispersal of asbestos. It was about a case where a manufacturer produced numerous products over the years containing asbestos. So it's not as if there was one piece of asbestos out there in the world and people became exposed to it and went back to their happy homes across the country and got sick. It does matter if the resulting injury element is in the definition of occurrence, as was the case in the Planko case, as opposed to here, where we don't have a resulting injury element within the definition of occurrence. It's true that for the policy to apply, there has to be an injury that takes place during the policy period, but that doesn't mean that you read occurrence as also requiring a resulting injury by definition. I'm not able to understand the respondent's position that the fire was uninterrupted. Clearly, there was heat, and the heat was continuous and uninterrupted, and the heat is what caused the various elements, tangible items of property, to become damaged. This happens in any fire. Even if it's a fire in a living room, It's the heat from the carpet burning that causes the couch to start burning and so on. I see I'm out of time. I'll leave one remark, which is I caution against trying to carve out the light on Google. Sometimes the precision of the law merely allows for the opportunity to get around it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you both for good arguments. It's an interesting argument that you make, and we will carefully consider it. We are now going to adjourn, and we'll reconvene at 1:30 for our third case of the day.